from Click for Life, Bill. He says, I've been listening to past interviews of Shane Douglas back in the mid to late 1999, where he was about to go to WCW. In the interview, he was talking about a possible feud between him and Ric Flair. I know they had one match at Slamboree in 2000, but why didn't WCW make this a major feud for the company? Why was there heat between these two?
Well, what Shane Douglas and ECW did was pretty unique in wrestling, in that you usually don't make somebody in another promotion one of the centerpieces of your promos, the one-sided feud. But there were some reasons that came together to make it so that feud never happened.
Yeah.
And part of it was Douglas, and it was pretty smart in the day. It really made Douglas seem like, you know, a rebel. There's got to be a better way of saying that, but you know, that it was here was something different. Here was a real heel, because Ric Flair was, you know, looked at as the top of wrestlers and the most respected one, and he came with this new thing and just really being disrespectful to him and just ripping him, calling him Dick Flair, and you know, saying he's old and should get out of the way and all this kind of stuff, and really just ripping him in a way that Flair took personally, and I could kind of see why.
Yeah.
And it worked for what ECW was trying to do, and what Shane Douglas was trying to do, set himself apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things that did that for both Douglas and the company. But then you take, you know, there wasn't a lot of respect for ECW in WCW. There wasn't a lot of respect, even though both WCW and WWF were more than willing to take acts from them. The idea was, well, you're a big deal in the small pond, and now you got to prove yourself. Plus, in 2000, WCW was just in chaos as far as booking went. And you put all those things together, it was lucky anything got accomplished, much less that kind of, you know, an unenthusiastic Ric Flair, Shane Douglas coming in with a lot of doubters and not being booked in a way that showed his strengths as a personality and his weaknesses. And then just, you know, some people that were in charge that couldn't book their way out of a paper bag, as the old cliche went.
Mm-hmm.
The old cliche got mangled. So
yeah,
all that together, I'd say. I kind of got it right.
Yeah, I think you did. And I think also, people who followed, and this happened, this was frustrating a lot, I think, even in the 1980s, when a wrestler would jump from a territory to the WWF, and, you know, Dick Slater would be a headliner in a territory, and he'd go to WWF, he'd be the rebel Dick Slater, and he was a mid-carder, and people thought, what, you know, or Baron Von Raschke or something would show up, and whoever, you know, would show up in the WWF, and they'd be like, hey, they're a bigger deal than they're being treated. Vince McMahon, and when you're as big as Vince McMahon, or WWF, or in this case, WCW at this point, you don't really necessarily want to honor the stature and push of another wrestler in another company, no matter who they are, based on what they said and did in that company. You give them a push based on your evaluation of their ability in the ring and as a promo, and their size and their look and how easy they are to work with and to a degree who your friends, who they get along with behind the scenes and that type of thing. Shane failed on a lot of those accounts. He was pushed in ECW and he was perfect for it in a meticulously booked structure like Paul Heyman set up, with great or novel opponents, you know, Sabu with his style, people had never seen, Terry Funk, you know, one of the greatest ever with a lot left in the tank at that point, and a variety of other really good fits for Shane Douglas in terms of they weren't really big, and it was a very promo-based gimmick that Douglas had, and he was able to shoot and say things that people had never heard before. I talk a lot about context and the impact
That's
that things have in a certain context. Shane Douglas ripping on Ric Flair is like, you know, it's totally different context and proportion, but it's like people are jaw-dropped that I'm criticizing Mick Foley, because there's this sense he's a hardcore icon, he loves the fans, he's so friendly at autograph signings, how can you say something bad about him? People were shocked, but that was when Flair started deteriorating a little bit. He had that bad booking run where he lost some of his favorable clout among smart fans. ECW was booked towards smart fans, and Douglas helped enhance ECW's image as being anti-authority. It also helped that Paul Heyman didn't like Ric Flair, and ECW's product was in many ways a reflection of Paul Heyman's personal grudges and beliefs. Douglas fit that context really well, transferring to WCW with bigger guys, better guys, more connected guys, and people who knew how to play politics better. Shane was just kind of lost. I mean, it was, like you said, it was a bad time to go in there, and Flair took it personally. He wasn't eager to make money for Shane or make Shane a bigger star and let him cash in on this, because those anti-Flair promos were coarse, they were harsh, and they were personal. And it kind of gets to the point where you're Ric Flair, you go, I don't know if I want to put this guy over. But part of it really is Douglas just was portrayed as a bigger star and a bigger deal in ECW to ECW fans than he would rightfully be perceived in any other context at that moment in time. I do think Shane hasn't talked about enough when it comes to what made ECW successful and what it was during its, you know, its first hot run in the second half of the 90s. I think Shane was a really big part of a really big piece.
Yeah,
of that
I think
puzzle.
So too. And then, you know, you take, it's kind of like what you said with Dick Slater, but I mean, you take a guy that's used to his maximum advantage, and then you put him somewhere else where he's not used to his maximum advantage. And it's even the Hulk Hogan thing. If you promoted after his big Hulkamania run, if you'd ever, not this would ever happen, but if you ever promoted him or Dusty Rhodes as just another guy, mm-hmm. then it would take away everything of who they were.
Yep.
And so you either have to use them as this way, and you know, just Shane Douglas, I mean, they weren't in any place to do it in the first place. You know, I mean, they couldn't have done it. I don't think WCW could have done it if that's what they really wanted to do, but they didn't really want to do it.
Yeah.
And Flair really didn't want to do it. Now, could there have been a program booked well between those two that could have been successful? Very well may have been. Very well could have been. And if that's the case, then Ric Flair and WCW didn't do what was best for their own business in that sense. But Lord knows, I mean, that was just, you know, there was a lot going on there. And there were some parts where Shane Douglas wasn't his, you know, wasn't his own best advocate in the way he acted and
right.
the way he was. So.
Yeah. All right. I think we got that covered. Let's move to the next question. Well, I might as well tie it in. We mentioned Terry Funk's name. Shiki says, you often mention that Terry Funk has a legitimate claim for the greatest wrestler ever. I'm only familiar with his 10 years in WWF, WCW, and ECW from 85 onwards, which, while remarkable in itself, is apparently only a relatively small portion of his entire career.
Yeah.
Please speak about the earlier parts of Funk's career most fans would not be familiar with and how his overall legacy makes him a contender for greatest wrestler ever. Thanks for answering my question.
I mean, to me, you saw that. It was good stuff. It's not the best. This is just my personal opinion. It's not the best Terry Funk stuff.
Right.
Terry Funk, I mean, first you had him as the legacy babyface in his father's promotion in Amarillo, Texas, where, you know, the Funks were just a part of the Texas culture. And also getting, you know, as his brother was the NWA champion, going around wrestling, you know, his brother considered a really good, really effective NWA champion that did a great job at it for 4 years. And he was the crazy little brother who would go into every territory ahead of time and wrestle the number one contender to be his brother's policeman. And supposedly, you know, he was going to knock the guy off. And instead, you know, lo and behold, your local hero would beat the brother of the world champion. Now the world champion has to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very effective at that. You know, he was going to almost be the bounty hunter and knock the guy off. You know, great promos, great doing that stuff. So national star very early in his career that really did well and, you know, had a lot of the craziness in him and not the hardcore, you know, he didn't do any moonsaults. He didn't do just hard wrestling and brawling and, He did a lot of that. Not chair shots, not all the stuff that he changed to do in ECW. And he did it because physically it was what he could do at that age and that point in his career. But then NWA champion was just a tremendous stab you in the back, crybaby, but tough heel. And, you know, had this, you know, that was, you know, against Wahoo McDaniel, against just all the NWA wrestling too, and particularly against Dusty Rhodes. As Dusty Rhodes was coming up and being the American Dream in the year of the Bicentennial in 1976 and rolling through that stuff, just natural enemies with Dusty Rhodes.
All right, that concludes the 5-minute free clip of today's VIP audio show. If you're interested in having access to the complete audio shows that run between 10 minutes up to sometimes an hour, hour 15 minutes each, just click on the VIP sign-up info button in the upper left corner of the screen at pwtorch.com on any page, right under our logo. And you can get more details on all the features you get with the VIP membership, including around 50 VIP exclusive audio shows per month, start to finish, along with a lot more ad-free access to the site, the PW Torch Today PDF bulletins that come out most days that I write with the breaking news and analysis, and so much more. Hundreds of back issues from the Torch newsletter, both in text and PDF format now, and a lot more. Just check out the whole list of VIP features. It costs $7.50 per month to become a member. It is cheaper if you subscribe for longer term. And we also have an availability of paper copy subscriptions to the Torch newsletter where you can have it delivered to your doorstep all 15 pages every week with news, analysis, exclusive columns, interviews, and more. And with a newsletter subscription, it's about 75 cents more per week to get the newsletter delivered to your home, but you get all the other online VIP benefits along with that. So basically, it's just cost of postage and printing we pass along to you. Otherwise, it doesn't really matter to us either way which option you choose. But if you'd like to get that 16-page paper copy delivered to your door, you might want to check out that option. Otherwise, you can go with the eSub option, and I hope you'll maybe give us a try for 1 month and see what it's like to have access to the complete VIP audio shows every single day. All right, that's it for me. Until next time, on behalf of the entire Torch staff, I thank you for listening, and I sign off.